Okay, so I'm pressing record and we're getting started. Okay. Excellent. Welcome. We're going to talk about leadership in times of crisis. And this is actually a shiur I prepared a number of years ago when it felt like things were especially tense. There was a war in Lebanon American politics felt especially tense. And now here we are, and it seems that leadership in times of crisis, unfortunately, is more apt now even than it was when I initially prepared this year. So with that in mind, we're going to learn three pieces together that give a sense of what real leadership is about. It's really about sticking your neck out when the easy thing to do would be to take one approach. The popular thing to do might even be to take that approach. The tried and true path might be to take that approach. And a real leader says, but the right thing to do is more courageous than that, and it's to take an opposite approach. And these three sources that we're going to learn, two of them are examples of leaders that did the courageous thing, and as a result, I think positive things happened for individuals or for the community as a whole. And the middle one, that's the first and the third. The middle one is an example of somebody who didn't take the courageous approach, and as a result, what negative calamity befell the community as a whole as a result. So we're going to learn those three pieces together, and I think it'll paint a picture exactly of what courageous leadership is. I call it leadership in times of crisis, but it's really leadership with courage. And that's really what we as a community need, are leaders who are not afraid to act with courage. So the first is a Gemara, which records the idea of writing down the oral Torah. And as we'll see in this source, there's a principle, everybody has the sheets, right? There's a principle based on Psukim that the written Torah is specifically supposed to be written. And in fact, there's a concern that quoting Psukim from memory is actually a practice that we're supposed to avoid, even though I myself am not as careful about this as I should be, and it's something that a lot of people do routinely, quoting Psukim from the written Torah from memory, but we're not supposed to do that. It's a practice that specifically, as we'll see in this source, we're instructed that the written Torah is supposed to remain written, and the oral Torah is supposed to remain oral. So we'll see this source. The Gemara in Temura says, "V'ihabile igarta mi'efshar le'mishlacha." This was about Rav Dimi, who wanted to send a letter to Rav Yosef, which contained ideas from the oral Torah, but he wanted to write those ideas down in a letter. And the Gemara asked the question, are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to send a letter in which you write down concepts from the oral Torah in writing? V'ha'amar Rabbi Abba, b'rei de Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, amar Rabbi Yochanan, but didn't Rabbi Abba, the son of Rabbi Chiya, the son of Abba, say in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that kos ve'halachos kisorev ha'Torah? V'halomed mehem eino notel schar. These are pretty strong words he has for somebody who writes down the oral law. Kosvei halachos, somebody who writes down the oral law, is like burning the Torah. And one who learns from those words doesn't get any reward for having learned them. That's, pretty extreme. So can you even write it down? Darash Rabbi Yehuda bar Nachmeni miturgamei deresh lakish. That Rabbi Yehuda bar Nachmeni explains that the basis for this concern is one pasuk says ketov lecha, write hadvarim ha'ela, write these words. V'akatuv echad omer, and a different verse says ki al pi hadvarim ha'ela, we live based on the mouth of these matters. Lomar lecha, it's to teach us. Dvarim she'al peh, this is the principle. Words that are supposed to be oral, iata rashai le'omran biktav, are not supposed to be written down. Vishe biktav, and those that are supposed to be written, meaning the written Torah, iata rashai le'omran al peh, you're not allowed to say them out loud. So there are two suggestions in the Gemara about why this letter might be permissible. One suggestion, which we're going to skip right past, is the suggestion that maybe new concepts are not part of the tradition, and so even though they're orally transmitted, you're allowed to write those down. That's one suggestion, that new concepts would be different. But the second is applying the principle of a different pasuk, one that appears in Tehillim, Eit la'asot la'Hashem heferu toratecha. There are times that we have to suspend the ordinary principles that we would generally apply. It's an eight, a time, la'asot la'Hashem, to take action on behalf of God. Amri, and this is the Gemara's principle, mutav te'aker Torah ve'al tishtakech Torah mi'Israel. It's better that we should uproot one small principle of the Torah in order to prevent the entire Torah from being lost. So what's the historical context here? There was a time shortly after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash when there was this concern starting to develop that Tishtakach Torah Mi'Israel, that the oral law, the Jewish community was becoming so fragmented, we no longer had a Beit HaMikdash where we were centered around, and we were in, it was the beginning of the exile. And at the time of the beginning of the exile, the rabbis of that generation, led mostly by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, said, we are in big trouble because the oral Torah is starting to become forgotten. It's very difficult in a time of exile to be able to maintain the oral Torah. And so this you see how strict they were about recording anything from the oral Torah, so much so that one rabbi wanting to send a letter to the other rabbi, he wanted to take out any Torah content from that letter, lest he be in violation of the principle of writing down the oral Torah. And yet Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said, Eit la'asot la'Hashem heferu toratecha. This is a time when the broader principle is the Jewish people need to remember the Torah. And so he recorded the Mishnah and the Braita and the Tosefta. He recorded it in writing, and we have oral Torah till today, the Talmud, the Gemara. The reason we have it is because they wrote it down. 2,000 years after that principle was applied, we still have Torah today, whereas perhaps he would have upheld the small principle and say, no, we can't write down the oral Torah. Instead, he said there's a bigger principle that trumps the smaller principle. And that's phenomenally courageous leadership. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just trying to get the time period. These rabbis that you quoted at the beginning, were they living at the same time as Rabbi Yehuda?
Correct, yeah. Shortly afterwards, actually. Rav Dimi and Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish overlapped. They were the earliest Amoraim. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the latest Tana. So the reason why he had already applied this principle of writing down the oral Torah, I'm gathering that it had not taken widespread hold yet. And so within the same generation, it was maybe 40 years later, Rav Dimi, Rav Yochanan, Reish Lakish, were all, Rav Yosef, were all... We're all critical of that practice, and Rav Dimi may have been a Tana, so that may have that for sure the same generation, either a little bit after Rav Yehuda Hanasi or a little bit before.
But they knew that it had happened, yeah.
So I'm gonna backtrack. I think Rav Dimi and Rav Yosef, the first two, are actually Tanaim right before Rav Yehuda Hanasi. And so the first application of this principle that's recorded in the Gemara is this time period now, that they allowed them to write down the letter that Rav Dimi was going to send to Rav Yosef. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi extended that principle and applied it much more broadly to the entire oral Torah. So it had initially been just a conversation between Rav Dimi, or a question Rav Dimi was posing. What's throwing me off is that usually a Tana is called Rebbe something, not Rav. But I'm sure that Rav Yosef was a Tana, and I think Rav Dimi was also a Tana. You have Google. Rav Dimi was.
Yep.
Okay, so now that we have definitive answers, so what we'd have to say is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had already applied this principle, but it had not taken widespread hold. He was the Nasi, so he was the leader of the generation, and so nobody would challenge his authority and his voice. Right. Meaning, I'm sure that it was a surprising position that he took, because it had never been done before. Nobody had written down the oral Torah before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi took that position. But he did it based on a pasuk in Tehillim, Eit La'asot La'Hashem Eferu Torah Techa, and he said it just makes sense, better that the Torah should be preserved than one small principle of Torah should be observed. Similarly, we have to be careful about when to apply this principle.
For that once, or then any, sorry, go ahead.
No, in general, I think a courageous leader has to pick your spots. The big picture takes precedence over the smaller principle. We part of the heter of pikuach nefesh for Shabbos is a principle of better that he should be able to keep many Shabbatot than we'll keep this Shabbat and then he won't be around to keep keep all future Shabbatot. So that you have to I guess be a superb level of leader to understand when to discern when. When do we apply this principle? What's considered a small principle? What's considered the bigger picture? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had the shoulders to be able to make such a decision that the greater principle is Torah should be al tishtakach Torah Mi'Israel. Torah should be preserved among the Jewish people. And the concern was that if I don't write it down, it's going to be forgotten. And so that principle that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi applied was then extended by Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, and Rav Dimi later than that. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were early Amoraim. Rav Dimi was, as we learned, third or fourth generation Amora. And I guess it took time until the principle, even though Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in approximately the year 200 had already written down the Mishnah and put it into codified form, the 63 tractates that we have now, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi already did in the year 200. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were still challenged with it 60 or 70 years later, and Rav Dimi a generation or two after that. Okay, that's one example of a leader who really stuck his neck out and made a courageous decision that we're still benefiting from to this day. The next piece on the next page is a famous story for this time of year, a Gemara about Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. And it's incredible because the story is so well known to us, but often the commentary or the analysis of the story is not. And the reason for that, I think, is because the Gemara of Kamtza and Bar Kamtza is one of the few pieces of Torah that we're permitted to learn on Tisha B'Av, because it's about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But the commentaries on that, you're not necessarily allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av, because the commentaries are considered more pleasurable Torah. So more pleasurable Torah, we're not supposed to learn on Tisha B'Av. The less pleasurable Torah, about the destruction itself, that we're allowed to learn. So here we're going to learn the Gemara with a commentary, and the commentary is what makes it so pleasurable. So we'll hopefully enjoy what we learn, but we'll also, I think, gain an insight into this story that we didn't necessarily have before. And this time we could do it in English since it's a lot longer. Yerushalayim, the Gemara says, Yerushalayim was destroyed due to the enmity between Kamtza and Bar Kamtza. The fact that their terrible relationship is what led directly to the destruction of Yerushalayim. And then there are two different opinions about what other things that led, other stories that led to the destruction. But we'll go straight to this story. A certain man had a friend named Kamtza and an enemy named Bar Kamtza. He made a banquet and he asked his servant to invite Kamtza, but his servant got confused and instead he invited Bar Kamtza. And the host then sees Bar Kamtza at the banquet and he becomes very upset. What are you doing here? You are my enemy, leave. And Bar Kamtza says, please don't embarrass me in public. And it's interesting here that the Gemara, noteworthy, that the Gemara says because of the animosity between Kamtza and Bar Kamtza, that's what led to this whole story. Really, you could say, it's because of the stubbornness of the host and the fact that he was so insistent. But that's, we'll leave that question for right now. The host says, you get out of here. And Bar Kamtza says, but let me stay. Please don't embarrass me. I'll even pay for my own meal. The host says no. Bar Kamtza answers, I'll pay for half of everybody's meal. And the host still insists. And Bar Kamtza says, I'll pay for the entire banquet. And the host still does not acquiesce. And he physically had him thrown out. And Bar Kamtza said to himself, there were chachamim around at this banquet. They saw this exchange. They could have done something, and they didn't. And therefore, I am going to tell on them and get them in trouble with the king. So what did he do? He went to the king and he said, the Jews have rebelled against you. And the king said, rebelled against me? Why should I believe you? And Bar Kamtza said, I'll prove it to you. Send them an animal for them to bring as a korban, and you'll see whether they bring it or not. Really, that would have been permissible, to take an animal that the king gave them and for the Jewish people then to sacrifice that korban as a korban nedava, a voluntary korban, in the Beis HaMikdash. But what Bar Kamtza did is he blemished it on the upper lip, some say in the eye, and it's not a blemish that the king would have considered a blemish, but it was a blemish that the Chachamim considered a blemish, and now it's not allowed to be brought. So turn the page for the continuation of the story. The Chachamim, some of them standing around, thought maybe we should still offer this korban, because after all, our relationship with the king is incredibly important, and it's better. You would think, what's the mindset of the Chachamim? It's better that we should violate one halacha, bringing a korban with a minor blemish, and maintain our relationship with the king, instead of having the king turn against us and think that we've rebelled. But Rav Zecharia ben Avkulu said, no. If so, people will say that we may offer blemished animals on the Mizbeach. And that's not correct. So he took a stand against all the Chachamim. This is leadership, but it's leadership of a different kind. He took a stand against the Chachamim and insisted that the specific halacha needs to be preserved, and even at the expense of angering the king, and so we have to preserve that specific halacha. So then, this is less important to where I'm trying to drive at, but the Chachamim thought to kill Bar Kamtza, lest he tell the Kesar that they didn't bring his korban. Let the king think that we brought the korban, even though we didn't actually bring it. And Rav Zecharia again speaks out and say, no, then people will also say that one who blemishes a korban is killed. That's going to be the incorrect principle. Now listen to the closing thought of Rav Yochanan. The humility of Rav Zecharia destroyed our mikdash, burnt our heichal, and exiled us from our land. It's because of this that the king came after us, got angry at the Jewish people, and exiled us from the land. So that's the story. So we may have learned this story or not, but this is a story that's repeated many years on Tisha B'Av, again, because it's one of these pieces of Gemara that you're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av. And it explains the context of what led up to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. What's incredible is that the language that Rabbi Yochanan uses to conclude the Gemara, Anvat Nuto Shel Rabbi Zecharia, it was his humility. And so the Marutz Chiyus, which we don't have to see, well, it's not really inside, it's my synopsis anyway. The Marutz Chiyus, who was a commentary in the 1700s on the Gemara, the Marutz Chiyus says that language was specific, that wording was specifically chosen by Rabbi Yochanan because he's criticizing clearly, his language is he's being critical of Rabbi Zecharia, but he's not saying it was his piety that led to the destruction, or his fidelity to halacha that led to the destruction. If so, it would be a positive word, but also ironic. Right? Rabbi Yochanan is not just noting the irony. The irony, we could all know. The irony is he was trying to do something good, and it turned out bad. He was trying to take the right approach, and instead it turned out to have a negative consequence. That's ironic. But the Maariv Chiyus says, no, Rabbi Yochanan uses the word, the modesty or the humility, and he means it in a critical fashion. He didn't have the guts. He didn't have the courage. Had he been more courageous, he would have said, better that we should bring one animal that has a minor blemish on the Mizbeach and not anger the king who ends up coming after the Jewish people and destroying the Beis HaMikdash, burning the Heichal and sending us into exile. Better that we would do that, but he didn't have the courage. And he was, I guess, strong enough or persuasive enough, even in his humility, that the rest of the Chachamim went along with it. Could extend the criticism.
Was he like a leader that everybody
It was, I don't know who he was. I don't know who he was. He was clearly one of the Chachamim, but he was, I haven't seen his name quoted other places. But he was obviously an influential enough Chacham that he had sway over the other Chachamim. And they went along with it. They didn't have the courage themselves to say, there was no leader. So not only did he exercise undue humility, but they didn't have the courage to speak up. And as a result, that led to the destruction. The rest of the story is that the Roman Caesar came after us. Yeah.
It seems like an unusual case because humility, I've never seen humility be a negative trait. Like we just had a share yesterday, that was a key point.
And leadership,
it's still ironic.
The story is, you know, the Chacham didn't stand up for the person who was being embarrassed. That's a different issue. But the one you're emphasizing is how this rabbi didn't give the right advice, but you know, people don't. It's like in the Holocaust, you know, why didn't the rabbis tell the Jews to leave? Nobody
right.
has a crystal ball.
Right. So, that also would be an interesting statement for Rabbi Yochanan to make, right? If he had said it's difficult for anybody to even be critical of Rav Zecharia, you're right, he doesn't have a crystal ball. So not knowing the future, so he did what he thought was best at the time.
Right.
And yet clearly Rabbi Yochanan comes in and is critical. So what's he criticizing exactly? Now I think it is, while modesty and humility is considered a virtue, We say Moshe Rabbeinu was anav mikol adam. He was the most humble. What does that mean? You see him do gutsy things all the time. He speaks up. He argues with God on behalf of the Jewish people. And he argues with the Jewish people on behalf of Torah principles. He was clearly a gutsy leader. What does it mean that he was humble? I think we all know, yeah.
No, I mean, just in reference to that, I think humility is used in a very specific way here, because he did have the guts to speak against what the other people were saying, because he was saying that we can't do that because the other Chachamim said, right, they thought to offer it, but he said, no, we can't, because then people might think. So it's not that he didn't have the guts to say something different. It's that he didn't have the right humility in seeing what Moshe saw, that he has all this knowledge and all this Torah knowledge that Hashem gave to him. So he has to trust in that. It's not coming from him, it's coming from Hashem. So he has to think about, Hashem is telling me from what I've learned and all that influence Hashem gave to me, that I know what the right thing is. And I need to say, through my knowledge that Hashem gave to me, what the right thing is to do.
Yeah, so inherent in what you're saying, I think, are a few things. But one of them is that appropriate humility is knowing what your capacity is, not thinking more of yourself than you are, and not thinking less of yourself than you are. That's Moshe Rabbeinu's humility, that he thought appropriately of his own abilities, not more, but not less either. And here, Rabbi Yochanan's criticism of Rabbi Zechariah is that he had more to him than he exercised. He thought he could have acted here. He had more influence, and he had more, perhaps, vision. He had more to him, and instead, he took a short-sighted approach. He could have, otherwise, it's exactly as you said, that how can we criticize him for, nobody has a crystal ball, all he can see is what he can see. But it seems that Rabbi Yochanan is taking the view that it was foreseeable, and maybe he did even foresee it, and instead he protected the smaller Torah principle instead of the greater principle, and because of his short-sightedness, that he decided to protect what was in front of his nose instead of what could have been potentially foreseen, maybe that was his undue humility. So otherwise, it doesn't really make sense to criticize him.
The Chachamim themselves were saying, gee, we're worried about how the king's going to react and reject his Torah. I mean, they definitely...
So maybe that's excellent, right? So they're even introducing the consideration of...
He said this in response to that. It seems like they have the crystal ball.
Right. And instead he came after them in a powerful way. He wasn't the Gadol Hador, so it's difficult to understand. So why didn't they push back harder? Right, somebody else could have stepped up.
Also, I mean, you do. I don't remember all the details, but you have that story of the learning, and there was the halacha, right, with the oven, and they all say it's one way, and he's like, no, and then the other rabbi says, no, it's this way.
Yeah.
And so he stood up for what he felt was true and right. But really, in the end, we learn from the story that, well, no, like, sometimes even if you feel so strongly about something, and technically he maybe could have been right, but it's not coming from the heavens, it's coming from
right
here.
But that the key principle that the Gemara learns applies from that story, Tanur Shalachnai, is the principle that we follow the majority, even if we have all kinds of heavenly indications that the minority position is right. We follow the majority because that's how God set up the rules. Our system is based on Acharei Rabbi Lito, that we follow the majority. Here, it's add that to our list of questions on this Gemara, because the majority took the position, the Chachamim, it's not clear that it was the majority, but the Chachamim, however many plural, multiple rabbis that includes, took the position that maybe we should offer the korban, and Rabbi Zechariah was a strong enough voice that he shot them down, and this is our example of the lack of courageous leadership, and my mother said that he didn't have the guts, and that's really the. That's really the idea that the opposite of what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did a generation or two later, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said, there's a big picture here of preservation of the Jewish people, continuity of our Mesorah, of our tradition, that trumps the minor local halacha. So this starts to get scarier and scarier to be a leader, because you have to know what's considered the broader principle and what's considered the local principle, and when the local principle should be suspended for the broader principle. And you see, one time Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi took a position and that was correct, and another time Rabbi Zachariah took a position and that was incorrect. But who's to say that there wouldn't be other times when a sage would take a position, or a leader would take a position that would actually, he or she thinks they're doing the right thing for the community as a whole, and in fact it turns out that it backfires, that it undermines the importance of halacha. These are the questions that you know, I think we can all chew on as we're contemplating these concepts. The last one is a fantastic shaila that was presented to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and it comes out first with a Gemara, and then the shaila that was asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein. So as I don't need to overemphasize to any of you, the concept of going to the mikvah without a chatzitza, without any impediment, is a halacha that's recorded even in the times of, going back to the times of the Gemara. The water has to be able to enter every area of the body and can't have any impediments to that, any chatzitza to that. And so that's why all the mikvah preparations that have been introduced into halacha have been introduced of not having any tangled hair and not having dirt on your fingernails. So that's why we cut the fingernails very short. And all of these other things, that they're all designed to avoid chatzitza, any impediment. So certainly you cannot go into the mikvah wearing earplugs, even though the water does not need to go... water does not need to go in every part of the body. It just has to be able to go into every part of the body. So, for example, you don't have to open your mouth. You don't have to stretch out your nostrils. You don't have to open your eyes and be blinded. You're allowed to keep your eyes closed loosely. Just can't have them closed so tightly that then the water can't even theoretically go to the wrinkles in your skin. So, but even though it doesn't have to, you don't have to get your ear all the way and have the water go through every crevice, but it has to be able to go to each of those crevices. And that the Gemara's line is, it has to be ra'ui lebiat mayim. Even if it doesn't require biat mayim, the water to actually come, it has to be ra'ui lebiat mayim. So that's true of the ear canal as well. You can't put in earplugs, because then it's not ra'ui lebiat mayim. Yeah. Okay, so this is the shaila that was asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein. The shaila that was asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein is, there's a woman who it's going to be physically dangerous to her health in some way for her to go into the mikvah without earplugs. And the question was asked, is she allowed to go to the mikvah with earplugs? Rav Moshe Feinstein at this time was incredibly young. This is Taf Resh Tzadi Dalid, which is 1934 roughly, and he was still living in Russia at the time. This was before Rav Moshe Feinstein came over to America. He was not the leader of the generation, Moshe Feinstein, who I think he died in 1984. So this is in his I think it was 80 or 90. He was in his 30s or maybe 40 at the time that he issued this ruling. So this is a pretty courageous decision that was made by Rav Moshe Feinstein. And wants to know is it was basically, these were primitive earplugs that take like a cotton ball with Vaseline and put it in the ear that then it would expand and prevent any water from coming in, and wanting to know, can you apply this? Is there any way that this could be permissible? And without getting into the logic of how he applies this, but there are a number of reasons why he says this is considered ra'ui lebiyat mayim still. It's still considered eligible to have water come to it, because without the earplug it would be eligible. That's a staggering comment for him to make. Without the earplug, it would be eligible. Well, you know, if I put on a bandage, without the bandage, it would be eligible. But the bandage is still considered a chatzitza. If I take a whole bunch of dirt and rub it on my arm, well, without the dirt, my arm would be eligible. With the dirt, it's a chatzitza. And yet, Rav Moshe Feinstein applies just his courage, I believe, in order to allow that this woman to go to the mikveh wearing these primitive earplugs, and this decision was then criticized by other leaders in the generation. So Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, who himself is a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, world-class Talmud Chacham, and considerably older than Rav Moshe Feinstein at the time, heard about Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak, and he wrote to Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grodzinski, who was considered the greatest sage of the generation at the time. This is all, again, around 1930s. And said, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky sent to Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grodzinski that how terrible is this that a rabbi would allow such a revolutionary idea as a woman going to mikveh wearing earplugs? And Rabbi Chaim Ozer wrote back to to Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, and you can see it here in the English on the last page. When Rabbi Chaim Ozer received the letter complaining, the letter from Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky complaining, he said that he too had written a response in permitting a woman to immerse while wearing earplugs, like Rav Moshe's opinion, but Rav Moshe's response was several levels deeper and more brilliant than mine. Rabbi Chaim Ozer added, there are two brothers sitting in Russia, and he was referring to Rav Moshe Feinstein and his brother Mordechai, who studied Torah the way they used to learn it hundreds of years ago. So look at the courage in leadership on two parts here. First of all, Rav Moshe Feinstein, as a young man, sticking his neck out to say, instead of, what's the alternative? This woman can't go to the mikvah otherwise. Or she'll risk her own health by going to the mikvah. And what's that going to do to the marital relationship between her and her husband? Rav Moshe bent over backwards to say there has to be some way to permit this. And so he found every legal and halachic loophole he could in order to permit it. And then look at the courage of Rav Chaim Ozer, that as the leader of the generation, you know, he has another Talmud Chacham, a rabbi, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, who he respected himself, being critical of Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak, and now Rabbi Chaim Ozer is at a crossroads. What does he do? So he not only defends Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak on halachic grounds, but he actually delivers a little bit of a critique back to Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, saying this is not only the right position on halachic grounds, but he explains it and he articulates it and he defends it with a level of scholarship and brilliance that harkens back to a generation ago, to hundreds of years ago, when people used to really learn Torah the right way. That's really courageous leadership on both of those counts. Yeah.
Woman, any woman, or for this woman with the medical conditions?
great question. I have to go back and look at the tshuva again. I'm very hesitant to say that it had the broad application of any woman's allowed to wear earplugs. I think it was that specifically this woman that we can suspend disbelief of certain principles in order to allow her to wear earplugs, but in general, that's not a practice that he wanted to see implemented everywhere.
If the water gets in the ear, you're going to get an infection. That can bring you antibiotics to even cure it quickly. That can bring together.
Is there a difference between the private and public? This ruling is a
right.
specific woman. The other two were public events.
Correct. So the to me, the interesting part of it is the exchange of Rav Chaim Ozer and Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky afterwards. Because, yes, to apply a localized, specific heter for one specific woman, you could say, okay, that's not such a big deal. But then you see that an older rabbi in his same generation was critical and was raking him over the coals about it to say, tattling on him to the rabbinic leader of the generation, Reb Chaim Ozer, and so then it gives added significance to Reb Moshe's psak. This wasn't just one conversation with one woman. It was a tshuva that he published publicly that he was then criticized for, and then you see You see then the broad shoulders that he had, that he was willing to defend his position and permit it for this woman even when a spotlight was being shined on it publicly. So though hopefully that we should all aspire to be led by a generation of leaders who have the guts and courage to apply real wisdom in implementing their halachic and their policy decisions. Thank you all.